All right, we got it going here. Turn that up just a little bit. Okay, there we go. All right, sir. We are here today. My name is Brady Banta. I'm interviewing Mr. Bill Stone. It is September the 26th, 2008, and we are at Mr. Stone's home in Bay, Arkansas. I am going to be tape recording our conversation for the Bracero History Project. You are aware that I'm tape recording it, and I have your permission to do so.
Yeah.
All right, sir. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Stone, to get this started, if you would, tell me a little bit about your background. Where and when were you born? Where did you grow up? And how did you get your start in farming? And have you always been in farming?
I've always been in farming.
All right.
I was born 1-7-23. My daddy was a farmer, and I grew up a farming, you know. He just farmed. I grew up in the 30s. You've heard about him.
Yes, sir.
I grew up in the 30s, and everybody that lived on the farm worked. By the time you was 5 or 6 years old, you went to the field and chopped cotton and picked cotton and done whatever there was to do. You had no question about whether you were going to work or not, and everybody worked. So that's the way I grew up. I grew up a farmer. My daddy was a farmer with a pair of mules, and you know, we just had 10 acres of cotton, but you grew hogs and cows and chickens. And that's where I grew up. My daddy was born in 1900.
Now, did you when you were growing up, was your father farming here in the vicinity of Bay?
Yeah, on this same ditch, about a couple of miles.
Okay.
And we lived on this ditch. His parents moved here in 1917, and they moved on this same ditch right here, 1917. We don't own that farm that they own, but he bought this in 1945. Yeah, 1945. And I bought it from him in 1975.
All right.
But he just farmed, and I grew up farming.
And when you finished school, you just went into farming with him, working for him or as a partner with him, right?
Yeah.
All right. You grew primarily cotton.
Back in them times, we just had small allotments.
Mm-hmm.
We grew corn and hay and had to have something to feed the mules, you know, and the cows and hogs. I tell you, it wasn't easy to make a living.
When your father moved, or when your father bought this farm in 1945, had the land all been cleared?
This land was cleared.
Okay.
The land that he first bought was in the woods, and we had to clear it.
Okay. Did you participate in the clearing of that land?
Well, yeah.
Can you tell me just a little bit about how you did that?
Well, he bought it 40 acres in the woods in 1936. He borrowed $400 from his daddy to buy that 40 acres. And he went back there and went to clearing with a crosscut saw and a chopping axe and a Kaiser blade. And that's the way he cleared it. He bought 140, and then a year or two he bought another one, and he wound up buying five. Yeah, he bought 540s over there. And wasn't much of it cleared. There's some of it cleared, but there wasn't much cleared. A lot of people have bought them in them 40s and cleared a little bit of them, and they got a chance to sell out and leave, and he bought them out. You know, 140 at the time, just scattered around. And that's where he got started.
All right, but this did, when he bought this, was had this been part of a corporate land that had been cleared, or he bought it from another farmer?
Bought it from a loan company. This 40 right here, about 30 acres of it hadn't been farmed in years. It grew up in Bermuda grass. And there's about 10 acres on the far side. This had been a farm for years. I don't know if my family owned it. I don't know that much about how many. But that part of there, and when the war broke out and they started building airports, they dug the Bermuda grass off of this and hauled it to Walnut Ridge to side that Walnut Ridge Airport. You've heard of things like that? Well, they dug the Bermuda grass off of that to haul that to side that airport at Walnut Ridge. And then they started farming it. It'd been farmed 1 year when Daddy bought it. They farmed it, and I think they planted it in squash. They hauled squash to Memphis to market.
So it was basically a truck farm that first year.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
But he bought it in 1945, and then we've been farming it ever since.
Okay. From that start of roughly 100 acres.
Yeah.
How big did the operation eventually grow to be?
Oh, my daddy, he just had about 600 acres. Yeah. 600 acres, and I bought a block of land in 1950, 65 acres for $3,000. There was about 15 acres of it cleared, and I've still got it. And a little over 400 acres.
Okay.
And then my daddy left. I got three sisters, so we got 100 acres apiece. We made a partnership out of it. And we've got all of 400 acres, and it's in a partnership with me and my three sisters.
All right, sir. When did you and your father first use Mexican migrant labor, and what prompted you to make the decision to contract for the Mexican migrant labor?
Well, there wasn't no labor, there wasn't enough labor around here to harvest the cotton. In 1952, we got Mexican labor to come in here and pick our cotton.
So you had a bigger allotment than you could. Then you could physically handle yourself.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
The first bunch we got, of course, we were just as green as anybody could be, and they was too, except one of them. One of them had been caught in a soup line during the 30s and the Depression, and he could speak a little English. But he got caught in a soup line, I think, in Detroit, and they hauled him back to Mexico. And he was over here for the first time since back in the 30s. And he could speak a little English, and we got by with him pretty good. You know, they was glad to get a job. When they got here, we give them a number and a $5 bill, and we took them to the grocery store. They bought a few groceries, and the next morning they sent what they had left to Mexico. They said their family was hungry and they needed what little money they could get to feed their family when back in Mexico. Now, you know, that's pretty curious. That's pretty serious for them people as well as us, you know. But he could speak a little English, and we got by pretty good.
All right, that first year, I mean, roughly how many people, how many Mexicans did you hire?
I think it was 24. Us and one more farmer went together and got them together. I don't remember how many acres he had and how many we had, but I think we got 24.
All right. How did you house them?
Well, we had a farmhouse, and we built bunk beds, you know, two by fours and double decked them. And give them a blanket and a bed and a mattress and a pillow. And I remembered a two burner kerosene stove. And they cooked their own food. And they ate tortillas and beans and chilies.
Now, this, you housed, you and the other farmer, yeah. Did you house them all together?
No, we had two houses.
Two houses.
Yeah.
So were these just old tenant houses?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And were they adjacent to your house, or were they out in the field?
They were out in the field.
Okay.
We had to haul them to the cotton field. We had to pick them up with a ton and a half truck, haul them to cotton field. I weighed their cotton for them. And they was hauled in here in an open-top truck all the way from Mexico. The first loads. Later in the years, they got to haul them in buses. But them first loads come in here in open-top trucks all the way from the border.
Now, who did you make arrangements with, or you and your father make arrangements with, to get these 24 laborers?
I don't really know. I had an uncle in the cotton gin business over close to Caraway.
Mm-hmm.
And that group of people over there kind of formed an association, and we got them through there.
So it was run through one of the gins in the area.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. That's something I've run into before.
Yeah.
They would work for you standard 5.5-day week?
No. They wanted to work 7 days a week.
Okay.
They wanted to go to the field early and stay late. And they wanted to work 7 days a week. We didn't work but 6 days a week, but they wanted to work seven.
Okay.
If we was picking close to their house, they might go pick a sack full on Sunday evening, and they'd have a sack full to start on Monday morning. There's curious people. You know, I'll tell you a good story on them. We'd park a wagon on one end of the field, and ordinary people would go to the other end to start and pick toward the wagon. The Mexicans wouldn't do that. They'd start at the wagon and pick that way and then carry it back. We started picking this field here one time, and I unloaded them on the other end of the field, and boy, they got out and started picking. Daddy come by after a while, they'd picked up the field a little ways and parked the wagon down here on this side, and they picked their tracks up and come to this end and pick back. I couldn't get them to pick toward the wagon. They would pick it from start the wagon and go the other way and then carry it. I've seen a little old Mexican, he wasn't that way, 140 pound, carry 100 pound of cotton from the other end all the way back here to the truck, to the wagon. You'd give him a rope and he'd hang his sack on a scales and you'd weigh him. And he'd climb a ladder and carry it up on a wagon and empty it. They wouldn't help each other get a sack in the wagon. They wouldn't help each other. They'd laugh at each other. But they wouldn't start at the other end and pick toward the wagon. You couldn't get them to. I thought I had them tricked to where they would, and they would not go to the other end and pick toward the wagon. They started here and picked that way. I don't know why. I never could figure it out why. Of course, in Mexico, they might have made them do that. I don't know.
The men that you would hire in these years, when they would arrive here, first off, did you hire them just to pick, or did you hire a crew to chop also?
We didn't hire crews to chop. We just kept them through the picking season.
All right. So they would arrive here about mid-September?
About the 20th or 25th of September, and most of the time they was going them out of here by the 1st of December. Sometimes they'd stay a little later.
Okay.
But, they lived just here under contract for so long. I don't remember how long, about 3 months, I guess.
All right. when these men would arrive here, were these people all, did they know how to pick cotton, or did you have to teach them how to pick cotton?
Well, I'm sure there was some of them that knew how to pick cotton, and they taught each other.
Okay.
They taught each other. They'd help each other a little bit, but they didn't help each other much.
Did you, with the, now, you said you first started using the Mexican laborers in 1952.
Yeah.
What was the last year that you used them?
1959.
From, and you told me in 1952 that you and a neighbor went together and contracted for roughly 24.
Yeah.
Did you contract for each of those 7 years after that? Did you contract for roughly the same number, or did the number grow?
Well, we rented different acreages, and it growed. We, I don't remember, but we had a few years we had more than 24. I don't remember how many.
Okay, but it never got to be like 100 or something like that.
Oh, no.
Okay. All right. Did you ever have any trouble with them as workers?
Well, I had one that gave a little trouble.
What kind of trouble was this?
You know, I didn't understand it. The Border Patrol said he was just a communist.
So they came here and got him and took him. The Border Patrol came here and got him and took him away.
They said he was a communist. They could tell. They could walk up into 24 or 5 Mexicans and they could pick him out. Border Patrol.
Now, was this from the Border Patrol office that was over around Blytheville?
Well, I'm sure it was.
Okay. Yeah. So it wasn't necessarily that you had a problem with him, but the government had a problem with him for some reason, so they got him and removed him.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you another story about one pretty big operator over here had a cotton gin. And he got a load in, you know, to pick his cotton and pick his customers' cotton. And he's trying to get one of them to pick. Go to work. Ah, he says, mister, he says, in my country, I'm a lot bigger than you are. He says, I just come for the trip. Yeah, I'll give you a cup of coffee. I got a cup of coffee.
Oh, I'm good.
But he said, I just come for the trip, going to see the country. Didn't cost me nothing.
Did they send him back?
Well, I don't remember that part, but I think he demanded that he go back.
He demanded
that. He didn't want to pick cotton.
That's
but
funny.
He said in his country, he said, I'm a lot bigger than you are in my country. He said, I don't have to deal with this pig. I got plenty of people to work for me. He said, I just like to trip over here.
You mentioned in our brief conversation before we went on the tape, or maybe it was only the first on the tape, that first group that you, I think it was only on the tape, but that first group you got here, in 1952, you had you got him here, and you gave each one of them a $5 bill, and you took him into town so they could buy some groceries. And they bought their what they wanted at the store, and then wanted to make arrangements to send the rest of their money back to Mexico. Can you describe how they did that? How did they send their money back home?
They fixed it up for me, and I bought them a money order, and you know, they mailed it. They had the address and everything on it, and I bought them a money order and sent it back with money order.
Now, was this something that then subsequently you did most weeks?
Yeah. Most of the weeks they sent a portion of their paycheck home.
So when you would, I'm assuming you and your father paid them once a week, yeah, on Saturday or whenever,
yeah,
it was,
yeah,
and you paid them in cash.
Yeah.
And then they would give you back a portion of it to take in and get a money order and send to Mexico.
Yeah.
All right. And did most of them do this?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess all of them did.
C- Can you give me any sense, how much money on a good week, how much money would one of these individuals make, and how much would he send home?
Well, now, well, I think with first year, I think we're paying them $2,500 to pick, and most of them could pick 200 pounds. That'd be $5 a day. Work 6 days, that'd be $30. And they would send probably 25 of it home. They'd send nearly all of it home for the first week or two, and then they'd send a little less. And they bought a lot of clothes and took back with them.
Well, tell me what it was, because I'm assuming that once a week you would have to take them into Bay or Truman or someplace.
Yeah, took them to Bay,
and because they would need to buy their groceries and whatever. Yeah. So tell me what it was like when you took them into Bay on, I'm assuming, Saturday afternoon. What was it like when, because I'm assuming you and everybody else was coming to town at the same time.
It'd be full of Mexicans, and they'd, of course, they'd visit with each other, and some of them knew each other, and they'd visit and talk a whole lot, and they'd buy their groceries, and they was ready to go home. But they bought a lot of clothes. You know, they had pretty big families, and I guess what clothes they bought over here was better than it was in Mexico. They'd buy blue jeans, overalls, and they bought a lot of old tires. They made their shoes, you know. They made them themselves out of old car tires. They'd cut them car tires up in pieces and take them home with them. They bought pedals, Singer sewing machines. They bought a lot of things like that and took it home with them. And sometimes they tried to get a gun home. I don't know whether they ever got a gun home or not, but they'd get them a bucket and put lard in it and drop their gun down in that lard. I don't know whether the Border Patrol found them all or not, but they tried to get home with a gun.
Now, how would the business people in town be able to communicate with them? Did they hire interpreters, or did they just made do, kind of almost like signing with each other?
Yeah. Okay. Them boys could figure. You know, they knew what they was paying for everything, and they knew what money was worth. They could figure. I don't know if anybody tried to beat them or not, but they wouldn't get by with much of it if they did.
All right. Now, can you tell me this program that provided these laborers was a program that was based on an agreement between the Mexican government and the American government, and a system had been set up where the American, I think it was Labor Department, would send out inspectors. Did you have any experiences with the inspectors coming, and if so, can you tell me about that?
Well, all I remember about them is when they was going back home, they'd come and check your books out. And they always, two or three times in a row, the last two or three years, they always found something wrong. We'd got to paying them more, you know. Just like everything else, going up, you know. But you couldn't satisfy that government man. He wanted you to quit using them. You know, he was in the Labor Department, and he wanted them to quit coming over here, and he'd rip you off. We didn't beat them out of nothing. We paid them everything we were supposed to pay them and done more for them than we were supposed to. But he'd always find something wrong.
Now, was he finding something wrong with your books or finding something wrong with the housing or the bedding or whatever?
I think it must have been the books.
Okay.
Because I don't think he went to the houses and checked them out. I don't know. I never could figure it out. But that time, that 1959, whenever they figured it out, charged my daddy. Pretty big pile. I don't remember how much. He said, "We won't never have any more business with you. You mark this down." I imagine he was pointing his finger at him. "You mark this down. Me and you won't ever have to do any more business together. This is our last time." And that's when I bought a cotton picker. He said, "Son, you'll have to buy a cotton picker." And this is what I told you a while ago. Is not on that tape, is it? About me buying that cotton.
No, we're going to just go ahead and relate that if you would.
Oh, he said, "Son, you'll have to buy a cotton picker." He says, "I'm too old." And I bought a two-row International cotton picker. And I had 125 or 30 acres of land and a tractor and equipment and an automobile, and that cotton picker cost more than everything I had put together. And me and daddy had 160 acres of cotton. And we picked it with that cotton picker, and it made us pay income tax. We didn't have to keep up with Mexicans. Didn't have to send any money to Mexico. And when we finally got it, cotton picker paid for.
Now, when you bought your cotton picker, there probably were other people around who had cotton pickers, but there weren't a whole lot of them.
No, there wasn't. I bought the only two-row picker that was in this Bay community.
Where did you have to go to buy it?
Truman. They had a dealer in Truman. They had a John Deere dealer and an International dealer both at Truman. And I bought a red one. I bought an International. It cost $17,000.
In 1959.
Yeah.
It's a pretty good piece of money.
It was then. It was then. It's different today.
Oh yeah. How long did it take you to pay that off?
Well, the way I remember it, I paid on it 2 years, and then I got my daddy's name off of that note. So I guess it took me about 3 years. By that time, I was ready to trade. I had to trade it off, you know, and get a new one. But we made it.
If you, and correct me if I'm wrong, when your father said, "I've had enough," and that he informs you that you've got to go buy a cotton picker, and you were, if not the first, one of the first in this area to purchase a cotton picker.
First two-row cotton picker.
First two-row cotton picker. Roughly how many years after that was it that everybody had mechanized?
Well, you know, it was more than you'd think. It was probably 6 or 8 years. There'd be one or two buy one every year, you know. Some of them buy one row, some of them buy two rows, according to how much there's farming. But they're still getting Mexicans for, 5 or 6 years.
Right.
Yeah.
Other than the fact that it changed, like, I guess, the way of life here, that you didn't have to have these hired laborers that you had to manage and sustain for 8 to 10 weeks every fall.
Yeah.
Was there any kind of a philosophical difference in the way and the approach to the way that you farmed when you had a cotton picker to when you didn't have a cotton picker.
Yeah, you need to keep it clean. You didn't want grass in your water. Cotton samples, you had to keep the grass out of your cotton. We put up fences and bought geese. Geese eat the grass out of the cotton.
Tell me about that.
Well, you had to put down a pump to pump water for them. Had to keep them water. And you'd feed them a little bit of corn. And they'd get the grass out of the cotton. They done a good job.
Okay, if you had... Let's say that by the time you bought that cotton picker, you and your father had 160 acres of cotton.
Yeah.
How many geese do you have to about keep the grass out of 160 acres of cotton?
I don't remember. I don't know. Best I remember, about 40 head.
Okay. And you just move them from field to field.
Yeah. Yeah, you had to put up a fence. You had to water them and feed them, and sometimes dogs would get in them and kill a few of them. Yeah. But they'd get the grass out pretty good. I think years later, that if we'd have near to use sheep, that the sheep would eat the weeds and the grass both and not bother the cotton. But we didn't figure that out till most of it had quit using stuff like that. But I think that if it was to do over, we'd probably use sheep. They'd eat the weeds and the grass both and trim the bushes out of the fence rows too.
From previous interviews I conducted several years ago, gentleman told me that the hardest thing he had to overcome when he made the decision to go from hand picking cotton to using a cotton picker was that at the end of the season, when they had finished hand picking, you would look at the cotton field and you wouldn't see any white.
Yeah.
And when you use the cotton picker, you always saw some white. It took him a while to get over that. Did you have any kind of transition like that?
When we started picking right out there, my daddy, he had a pick sack. He picked up the cotton as left. You know, it was a big deal. And he come up there and he said, "Son, there ain't no cotton left out there." So he picked up maybe 2 pound on 2 rows. He said, "There ain't no cotton left out there. I believe you can pick this cotton." And he quit going to field. And this ditch dump out here was a new ditch dump, and it was hard to get up on with a cotton picker. Then cotton pickers had a little old wheel about that wide on the back, and it was hard to turn. He hired some hands and hand-picked it. That land on that ditch dump, when he got it ginned, he said, "That's the last bale of cotton I'll ever hand-pick." Says, "It cost me more than I got out of it." Says, "I won't hand pick no more." Says, "What that picker don't pick, we'll just not worry about it." But he picked up 2 rows of cotton, and he said, "Before we bought that picker, we picked a 1-row picker right out here. Picked a few rows. And I don't remember how much it was, but we waited around a week or two and got some hand pickers to pick it, and they didn't pick any more than that cotton picker did after waiting a few days for get some hands. Why, he said, "Son," he said, "we picked as much of that picker as we pick them with these hand pickers." But we done backed out buying that cotton picker and it was gone.
Well, is there, let's see. You've told me about the difficulties you had with the inspectors from the Labor Department. During any of that period from 1952 to 1958, do you remember having any problems with the laborers themselves?
No. They didn't. We just didn't have no trouble with them. They'd just go out there and pick cotton. Like I told you, they liked you because you had a job. You let them work and you'd pay them. You know, they're glad to get the pay. And they sent most of it all to Mexico. They didn't spend much here. They'd buy beans and make tortillas. And that was about all they.
When they had their, I guess, when they had the day off on Sunday, because you didn't take them to the field.
No.
What did they do?
Well, they washed and cleaned everything up, washed their clothes, and they took a bath, whatever, you know, they pitted around the house cleaning up. One time I let them drive the truck, had one that could drive, and let them drive a truck, and I didn't see him, but I heard he went to Truman. But they didn't know.
Going to Truman for the transcriber here. Bay's in a dry county and Truman's in a wet county. Yeah. So he went to Truman. Right?
Yeah. But we got by with it. They didn't pick them up. They got back home. I don't know how scared they got, but they got back home. I'll tell you another one. We had one that hurt his back. And some of them was about as well educated as I was. And I let him be the way boy. And it suited him just fine. And it come getting time to go home, and he began wanting to go home, and I wasn't ready for him to go. Oh, he says, I need to go home. And he began telling me what all he had to do when he got home. He had some corn. He had some beans. I think he said he had 8 head of mules. So he's a pretty big farmer back home. And I'd come up short that year. I said, well, how about me going down there and living with you and working for you this winter? Okay. I said, how much you pay me? He said, 60 cents a day. I said, don't believe I'll go. But he said he'd pay me 60 cents a day.
So that was, your impression was that was the prevailing wage down there. And you're paying them $2.50 a hundred, so they're going to make $5, $7.50 a day here.
Yeah. He'd pay me 60 cents if I'd go down there and work for him. He said, you can go work for me this winter, and I'll pay you 60 cents a day. I said, I don't believe I'll go.
Well, do you have any other memories or stories that you'd like to tell us that my questions haven't prompted you to relate to us?
No, I reckon I pretty well told you what I know.
All right, sir, I'm going to...
It'll be all right.
Okay.
It'll be all right.
Okay, we're back going again.
We went to Memphis, had a meeting with the Labor Department. And the farmers was going up and talking and telling all this good stuff. And I remember one particular farmer got up and told a man, he said, I think he had 18 or 20 two-row tractors. I'd have a driver for every one of them. Told how many people he was working and all that good stuff. After a while, the Labor Department had a man to get up. instead of paying them $2.50 a hundred, the labor department ought to be paying them $4 a hundred. And he just kept it. And of course, the farmers, they just hooted. You can imagine the farmers are hooting him around, you know. And this old big dude from the labor department got up and he says, "Now we've sat here and listened to you farmers cry and complain, and you're going to sit here and listen to him." But they told that fella, he said, "If you do what you say you're going to do, I won't need these people. You know, they'll be yours. You'll take them somewhere else because I won't need them." Well, the farmer was right. We got rid of that labor business. There was areas that the black people, farmers used a lot of them. Mm-hmm. They had a lot of them and they used them. Now, what they paid them that, I don't know. We didn't use them. We didn't use very many. I never did use them, black people. One time I had a busload out of Memphis come chop cotton for me a day or two, but we just didn't use them. We used white people, local people, and managed to get by. But whenever you're using that many, they just get rid of them. I had an uncle or a cousin that moved down to Elaine 1964, and they was just shacks all around down there, full of black people. He got rid of all of them. They can get by without them. Them local people didn't think they could, but when somebody else moved in, they got by without them. They run them all off. They filled up Chicago and a lot of other places. Whether it was good or bad, I ain't got the answer for it. It changed things. It changed a lot of things. And whether it was right or wrong, I don't know. I'm sure the black people were mistreated. I know there was, way back when. But during that time, I don't know whether there was or not. I don't know. I just don't know.
When they mechanized around here, that the amount of labor they needed just the bottom fell out of it. Yeah. They didn't need them anymore.
Yeah. And when the prices went up, labor prices went up, they managed to get by on a lot less labor. Bought bigger tractors and needed less help, you know. Now, where all they went and what all they done, I don't know. But they left. I don't know.
And I guess that started a, I don't know if you want to call it a vicious cycle, but it started a cycle, because once you had to have, if you were going to work with fewer people, you had to have bigger equipment, and to make the bigger equipment pay, you had to farm more land. Yeah. So the smaller farmer starts getting squeezed out because he can't afford the bigger equipment.
Well, y'all, back then there was a house on every 40 acres. Right. Some of them had two houses. Now you can't hardly find a house out in the country.
Yeah.
Now, school buses run all over this country and just fill up, and now they run all over the country and no hard to get anybody.